Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So today we thought that we'd take a deep dive into one of the most important topics of the day, and that's immigration and border control and everything related. It's been one of the major issues confronting the nation. It's been a centerpiece of public dialogue for a while. Before the 2016 election, immigration was already one of the most bitterly contested issues in Congress. We have seen the development of a hardline anti-immigration caucus within the Republican Party. Republican presidents such as George W. Bush had to confront this. And we've seen various initiatives, including under former President Barack Obama, fail for some kind of immigration control package. President Trump had made this the opening argument of his campaign, where immigration was part of his initial announcement. He's come back to this theme again and again. And in his first weeks as president, he's used executive power to try to move forward on this, most notably with the ban on refugees that is now tied up in the courts. So though we are a nation founded by immigrants and with a continual flow of immigrants, this remains one of the most contentious issues in American politics. And our guest today, no one could be better, Douglas Massey, the Henry Bryant Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs here at Princeton University. Professor Massey is one of the nation's leading experts on immigration, as well as many other subjects, race, housing, education, discrimination, and more. He's the author of many, many books and articles, including Climbing Mount Laurel, The Struggle for Affordable Housing and Social Mobility in an American Suburb with Princeton University Press, Brokered Boundaries, Creating Immigrant Identity in Anti-Immigrant Times with Russell Sage, and Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, also with Russell Sage. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So could we just start with a basic question? We always hear about the border problem, and this is something that you hear in campaigns all the time. Is there a border problem facing the nation?
Well, it depends on how you define a problem. At this point, illegal migration from Mexico has been over for about 8 or 9 years. The flow from Mexico stopped in 2008. It went negative in a big way during the Great Recession from 2008 to 2009, and there was a net loss of 1 million people from the undocumented population. And since 2009, the flow has been from Mexico has been negative, fluctuating around zero and negative. And the only flow left on the border at this point are some Central Americans who were always there, but when there were 1.5 million apprehensions of Mexicans back in 2000, they just got lost in the shuffle. But now they stand out because they're the only traffic along the border. And border apprehensions are actually at their lowest level since 1971, despite the fact that in 1971 there were only 1,700 Border Patrol officers looking to catch people, and now we have 21,000 looking to catch people. So really, the border is about as controlled as any border anywhere in the world. It's the most militarized border anywhere except for the division between the two Koreas. And building a border wall at this point is a complete and total waste of taxpayer money because the flow is at net zero and has been for 8 or 9 years. And the flow from Mexico is probably not coming back because of the demographic transition in Mexico. In the 1960s, Mexican women had 7 children per woman. And by 2003, it was down to 2.3 children per woman, and today it's around 2.2 children per woman, which is replacement level. So Mexico's become an aging society. The average age in Mexico is now 28 years old, and migration is very age-dependent. And if you don't migrate between the ages of about 16 and 30, you don't migrate at all. And so basically Mexico's aged out of the migration-sending ages. And that's the prime reason that the flow finally came to an end because of the demographic shift in Mexico, and it turned to it becoming an aging society.
But what about, you said that the net flow switched in 2008, 2009. What about economic forces? So it seems to me that some of this is people attempting to go find a place where they'll be better off. And so that condition can change, right? So like you said that now there's immigration from Central America or migration from Central America to the U.S. So those people are people who still want something better for themselves, and that and the something better for them is in the U.S. So can't that condition change over time?
Well, I've done a lot of estimates looking at the different factors on the economic conditions on both sides of the border versus the demographic conditions. And if it were just the economic fundamentals in Mexico and the U.S., there would still be an illegal flow and still be a net positive flow for Mexico. But it's really the demographic shift that has pushed migration rates way down. And this decline really started around the year 2000. And it was the flow out of Mexico was dropping rapidly after 2000. And it was really the Great Recession in 2008 that just put a definitive end to it. But the economy on both sides has recovered. And to the extent that migration is continuing, it's now in legal statuses. So there are about 150,000 to 200,000 permanent residents coming into the U.S. from Mexico each year, and 350,000 to 400,000 Mexicans on temporary work visas of various sorts coming in each year. But these people are circulating increasingly back and forth and not settling. So ironically, we've got legal migrants circulating back and forth across the border between Mexico and the United States, and a large undocumented population basically trapped north of the border because they can't go back and forth across the border. And so
because if they left, they couldn't come back?
If they left, they would be difficult, hazardous, and very risky to come back. And they don't want to face the gauntlet at the border at this point. And now, since no new migrants have been arriving since around 2008, the Mexican population, the undocumented population, is aging in place in the U.S. And so the average Mexican, the average undocumented migrant's been here like 15 or 20 years at this point. A big chunk of the population are now parents of U.S. citizen kids. And so we have U.S. citizens' welfare at risk if we can't find a pathway to legalization for the 11 million people who remain out of status today.
And you talk just if I you talk about circular flow is a term I've heard you use, and you just mentioned it a little bit. So,
well,
how does that work?
Mexican immigration is a very old phenomenon in North America. It goes back to the early 20th century, and especially to 1907. When the U.S. reached its gentleman's agreement with Japan, which cut off the flow of Japanese workers into the West, which immediately created labor shortages, and U.S. employers began recruiting Mexicans. Conveniently, the Mexican railroads had been funded by American investors, and the lines went north-south, so the recruiters just followed the rail lines down to, they came to the population centers in Mexico and began recruiting Mexican workers who came up on the railroads. And Mexican immigration boomed once the U.S. ended the First World War because after 1914, immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe was cut off and the industries were booming and gearing up for the war. And then when the U.S. entered the war in 1917, the U.S. government set up a labor recruitment program to complement the private efforts at recruitment. And when the U.S. passed its quota acts in the 1920s to prevent Southern and Eastern Europeans from entering the country, the United States, Mexican immigration boomed, and the Mexican population doubled in about 10 years. And that all came to an end with the Depression in 1929, and suddenly they people who had been encouraged to migrate were no longer welcome, and 450,000 people were deported between 1929 and 1935. And then in 1942, the United States found itself in another war, and with mass mobilization and a draft, labor shortages cropped up, especially in southwestern agriculture, and the U.S. approached Mexico and started another guest worker program called the Bracero Program, and continued to expand this program after the war ended until the late 50s, when about 450,000 Mexican workers were annually entering the United States each year for temporary work in agriculture, food processing, and other seasonal industries. And we had about 50,000 permanent residents were entering the country each year. So most of them were actually circulating rather than settling.
So just to get a feeling for what it was like at that time versus now, these programs, did they involve a lot of careful documentation? Was there in some sense a closure to make it hard to get in, or were these relatively open gates?
Fairly open gates. In 1953, 1954, just after the Korean War, there was a recession in the United States, and the Republicans came to power for the first time in decades under Eisenhower, and this was the first real border crisis since the Depression, and they launched Operation Wetback. with a million apprehensions along the Mexico-U.S. border.
There was no wall or fence at the time. It was just
Just crossing points.
Crossing points.
And so they arrested these million people. And if you listen to people like Mr. Trump today, they'll say, oh, we need another Operation Wetback that really did the job. It stopped illegal migration. Well, illegal migration stopped after that, but that was because they dramatically increased the size of the Bracero program, going from about 120,000 people to 450,000 people. And that was enough to satisfy the labor demand. And they usually work they began with issuing labor permits through the U.S. Department of Labor. It was a simple labor act. And literally, at the height of Operation Wetback, the INS, the Immigration Services, were going into fields and factories in the Southwest, arresting all the workers, putting them on a bus, bringing them to the border, dumping them across, and they would be met by a representative from the U.S. Department of Labor on the Mexican side, processed as braceros, put on a bus, and brought back to where they were working before. So they just did a switch-o, change-o. And the status quo ante basically continued, only now they were no longer illegal migrants. They were invisible bracero migrants.
And then you said we've militarized. That's a striking statement when you say we have the most militarized border other than Korea. When does that happen?
That really, to understand what happened, we have to go back to 1965 when Congress amended immigration law. And it did two things in 1965. First, it did these things with all great intentions. It was not seen as immigration policy. It was seen as civil rights policy. So they wanted to deracialize the immigration quota system, which had discriminated against Asians, blacks, and Southern and Eastern Europeans, and create a more open system. And they also wanted to reform the Bracero program, which had come to be seen as an exploitative labor program akin with Southern sharecropping. And so in 65, they passed amendments to the Immigration and Nationality Act, which created a new system that handed out visas not by national origin, but by family connections and labor needs. And each country got the same quota, 20,000 visas per country per year. And they also, Congress let the Bracero program lapse at midnight on January 1st, 1965. And so over the next several years, originally the Western Hemisphere was not under the 20,000 per country per year quota system, but a hemispheric quota of 120,000 visas. But by 1976, Congress had phased in the same quota system in the Western Hemisphere. So between 1965 and, say, 1975, you go from a system where there are 500,000 Mexicans circulating in and out in legal status to a new status quo where there are new numerical limits on the number of legal immigrants who can enter with permanent resident visas. It had been 50,000 before, and now it's capped at 20,000, and no guest worker program whatsoever. And so the economic conditions on either side of the border didn't change. And so the flows just kept continuing. Over the 22 years of the Bracero program, millions of Mexicans had come in and out of the United States, established relationships with U.S. employers, learned their way around. And after the Bracero program ended, they just continued migrating back to the same places.
So the change is similar numbers of people circulating back and forth, but in 1965, the legal means for doing so went away, and so they just kept on doing it. Is that?
That's right. Basically, we curtailed the opportunities for legal entry, and since the economic fundamentals really hadn't changed, the migration persisted. But what happened from 65 to 85 is now these were undocumented migrants. They were illegal migrants. So by definition, if they're illegal, they're lawbreakers and criminals. And this begins the whole development in the American media and popular culture of what some observers call the Latino threat narrative.
This is in the 80s?
This is starting in starting in 1985.
Okay. Right, because in your recent papers, you've written about a turning point in, I guess, circulation starting around 86. And so I wanted to talk about
The Latino threat narrative really started coming to a head in the 70s and early 80s. And in the context of Reagan's prosecution of the Cold War, the Mexico-U.S. border once again became this symbolic barrier between us and the communists to the south. If you want to get a sense of the zeitgeist, go rent Red Dawn and watch it It's
Wolverines.
Wolverines. It's where we're being invaded by paratroopers who are Spanish speaking, commanded by Russian speaking officers.
Oh, really? I thought this invasion was through North Dakota. Was it from the south?
Western Colorado.
Yeah, it's this crazy movie.
It's Eastern Colorado.
I remember the movie. I don't remember. Yeah,
iconic.
But anyway,
commies from the south.
So this rose to a heat, and in 1986, Congress passes the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which does three things. It gives legal status to people who had been in the country for 5 years or more at that point, and a special legalization program for agricultural workers, which got the agricultural grower lobby to support the legislation. It also criminalized moving forward undocumented hiring, so it became illegal to hire somebody after 1986 without documents. And it launched what proved to be a multi-decade-long buildup of enforcement resources along the Mexico-U.S. border and started the process of militarization.
Like fences and armed guards.
Initially, it was just more Border Patrol officers.
And between 86 and 2008, does that militarization have any effect on the flow or –
It starts slowly and expands dramatically in 93 and 94.
Under Clinton.
Under Clinton. These are bipartisan policies. This has been a bipartisan effort at militarizing the border. So in 93, the Border Patrol launches Operation Blockade in El Paso, and that proves so popular that good people of El Paso elect the chief of the Border Patrol office there as their congressman, and Clinton administration.
Who's that?
A guy named De La Vigna. And Clinton, being the politician that he is, saw that this was very popular, and so he authorized launching of Operation Gatekeeper in San Diego in 1994. And this was the beginning of all-out militarization, where you just erect a wall, a literal wall, for these segments of the border in El Paso and San Diego. And after that, the number of Border Patrol officers and the resources devoted to Border Patrol efforts skyrocketed and going up exponentially, with a pause around 2000 because nobody cared about immigration by 2000 because of the boom of the 90s. Mm-hmm. But then after 9/11, it resumed its exponential shift upward. So from 85 to 2005, we go from about $200 million to about $4 billion in border enforcement resources. And the Border Patrol goes from about 2,000 officers to today's 21,000 officers.
And you can see, so the main effect, though, that's always fascinating is you say that has the effect of keeping people here rather than keeping people out. People are trapped.
Caging, almost. I think, is the word that you use.
I didn't come up with that. Other people came up with that.
Yeah.
But that's the term that came to be popular. It did two things. First was the caging effect. You made it very difficult, very costly, and very risky to cross the border without documents. And instead of crossing in urban areas like from Tijuana to San Diego, the flows were diverted out into the Sonoran Desert through into Arizona, a much more hostile territory, or diverted away from El Paso into the lower Rio Grande Valley, which is wild country. And so
movies like, I think the movie
El Norte
is about crossing under hazardous conditions.
But that's before the Operation Gatekeeper.
Really?
That was a crossing in Tijuana.
Oh, okay. All right. Uh-huh.
So what happens is the death rate goes way up and becomes much more dangerous. The costs go way up because now you're not – before, the services of a coyote or a border smuggler were you just guide him across the border from Tijuana to San Diego, leave him at a 7-Eleven in Chula Vista where he calls his uncle in L.A. to come pick him up. Once you're out in an open country in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, high desert country, very cold at night, hot during the day, scarcity of water, you need staging areas, you need trucks, you need safe houses on both sides of the border. And the cost of an average border crossing goes from about $500 crossing to around $3,000 a crossing. And so people, when you make border crossing risky, dangerous, very unpleasant and expensive, people minimize border crossing. And they do this not by staying home, but rather continuing to access the jobs that still exist in the U.S. and just hunkering down once they've crossed the border.
I see. So therefore, the wall doesn't keep people out. It keeps them in.
Yeah. And you know, this is just not a speculation on my part. This is what the evidence clearly shows. After 1986, the probability of return migration from without documents begins to decline, and then it accelerates with the launching of the border blockades in the early 1990s. And it ultimately falls down to close to zero today. And so basically, the other thing that it did was by diverting people away from California, it pushed them into Arizona, made Arizona suddenly a hotbed of undocumented migration sentiment. But more importantly, people were now 1,000 miles away from their labor markets, traditional labor markets in California. And so, and this was in the context of the boom of the 1990s, and there were jobs opening up all over the country. So basically, we spent $3 or $4 billion a year during the 1990s to transform what had been a circular flow of male workers going to three states into a settled population of families living in 50 states. Because as the male workers stayed longer and longer and longer, the wives wanted to rejoin them, and so they did. And they arranged for their passage into the U.S. They settled. Once they're in the U.S., these are people in their 20s, so naturally they're having kids. And so you get U.S.-born kids. And it becomes very difficult to go back to the status quo ante of circular migration once that has happened.
So, pop culture question. So, in the Super Bowl, there's this ad by 84 Lumber, right? Have you seen this ad? That's about a woman and her daughter who want to cross the desert to get into the U.S. So, what you're saying is that it's someone, and it's them trying to get there, and they get to a wall. So, at some level, what you're getting at, like, there's an aspect of what you're describing, which is that that commercial, which is kind of heartrending, is actually not the practical consequence of what's happening at the border. It's just – it's a little parable about what happens when we close the border, but it's not actually the true major effect.
No, the major effect is really to keep people in rather than keep people out. And
what would a commercial like that look like?
I encourage your listeners to go to YouTube and watch this segment from a TV show called Adam Ruins Everything on the border wall, where he goes through, and I have a cameo role, my first dramatic role on television.
Awesome. What? Who carries this show?
It's on YouTube. It's True TV.
Oh, okay, right.
They lay it out in about a 6 or 7 minute vignette that makes it all very clear what was happening and do it in a very entertaining and humorous way. So it's the most effective thing I've done, way more effective than any of the New York Times op-eds I've written because it's gotten almost 4 million views at this point.
So what, I mean, obviously I'm sure that resonates because what you're saying is so counterintuitive to everything we hear about immigration, how border security works. You're reversing the storyline in many ways. So I guess my question is, why do people believe the opposite? Why is it hard to convince people of it? Is it myth? Is it quote unquote fake news? Or are there disputes about this?
Well, there's no disputes among people who know what's going on, the experts. If you look at all the estimates and all the studies and all the data, they show that undocumented population exploded in the 1990s, went from about 2 million in 1988 to about 12 million in 2012. But it was slowing down after 2000, and it was only incrementally increasing from about 11 to 12 million over those 5 years or so. And then it plummeted, and then it's remained stable. And that's what my data from my project, the Mexican Migration Project, show using survey data that I collect originally in Mexico and both sides of the border, really, and migrant histories that I analyze. It's also the estimate shown by the Pew Research Center's estimates, and it's also Homeland Security's estimates. So it's everybody's estimates are saying the same exact thing, that illegal migration population growth stopped and reversed itself in 2008.
So from the point of view of a country that presumably is more aware of what the facts are, for instance, people in Mexico and the Mexican government, they must be aware of this because it's Mexican people and their families who...
Oh, of course they are.
So what does this wall thing seem like to them? Does it just seem crazy?
No, it doesn't seem crazy. You have to understand that when people in Washington, D.C. make immigration policy, they don't make immigration policy thinking about immigration as a process and how they want to affect it. They use immigrants as ploys in a kabuki show for an American audience. So they're making immigration policy with an eye towards affecting U.S. public opinion and mobilizing political support for things they want to do. So scaring people about an invasion of illegal aliens from south of the border was a good political mobilizer for a lot of people to get resources for their agencies, heads of the INS and heads of the Border Patrol, to sell books and TV time. time, people like Lou Dobbs, and to political entrepreneurs like Donald Trump, who could rabble-rouse a crowd of people against immigrants, even though they were no longer coming to the United States. And it was much more useful to have the undocumented immigrants in people's minds than to actually tell them, well, it actually ended in 2008.
But one consequence of this is that if it's not going to have very much effect, then getting back to what I was saying, if from the standpoint of Mexican people or the Mexican government, it doesn't. The construction of a wall wouldn't have a practical consequence, and so therefore, is it just an expression of hostility?
Exactly.
I see.
So the borders become a symbolic trope in the American political debate, so that whatever threat appears to the United States at any point in time, the ready solution for all crises is close the Mexico-U.S. border. We saw this when Al-Qaeda came to the fore, close the border. When ISIS comes out, close the border. When Ebola struck, close the border. It's just the all-purpose solution to any threat that comes to the United States, ignoring the fact that we have two oceans and a northern border. And it's already the most militarized border anywhere in the world. And adding more border enforcement to one single border where three borders are pretty much undefended doesn't make much sense. But it is a symbolic gesture that signals to the base of the Republican Party at this point that these are people we don't want in the United States. They cannot be Americans. They're not real Americans. We're blocking the entry of these people, and we're going to send the ones that are here back. And likewise, the ban on Muslim immigration. These are people who can't be Americans. They won't be Americans. It's a strong symbolic signal to the debate, to the base. In either case, it has no real practical effect in increasing U.S. security. None of the countries where the ban has taken place were involved in terrorist attacks in the United States. And Mexico is a peaceful trading nation, one of our closest allies. Mexicans correctly perceive it as a slur and an insult.
So with Mexico, we have policy that's not based on the data and the facts. We have also a policy that actually probably aggravates the issues that are being discussed. It has the opposite effect of what you're talking about. And it's driven primarily, according to what you're saying, by racial politics, symbolic politics, partisan politics, whatever the motivation is, this is a way to drum up a base in both parties.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people and interests out there with money to spend that would rather have people worried about brown people from south of the border than white guys in New York City reorganizing the economy to take money out of the pockets of workers and put them into financiers in around Manhattan.
And there must be like an immigration industrial complex, I assume, given the militarization.
The prison industrial complex kind of came to a peak around 2000, and the fastest growth since then has been with the immigration detention system, which expanded dramatically with the rise of deportations under President Obama. And so now you'll notice that the Border Patrol Union and the ICE Union, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Union, supported Donald Trump. Corrections Corporation of America and GeoCorp supported Donald Trump.
These are private companies.
These are private companies that Obama had announced he was phasing out private jails. And GeoCorp and CCC stock plummeted. The day after Trump was elected, their stock surged.
So you are painting this then as these as including the union of workers, of Border Patrol workers, as being organizations acting in their economic self-interest.
Sure.
Okay. So let me pivot a little bit to connecting the dots here. Now we're on the topic of the Muslim ban, which is not a ban. It is a ban. You said the ban, the word ban. Anyway, but the 1965 Immigration Act, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, as an act to make in some ways the immigration process fairer and more egalitarian.
Right.
So right now in the news is the Ninth Circuit Court considering whether to block the ban, and there are various legal reasons that are being offered, you know, equal protection, you know, say the establishment clause, not establishing a religion. But another seems to me to be the 1965 Immigration Act. So is that order legal under the 1965 Immigration Act?
It's an ambiguous question that the courts have to decide.
Yeah.
The intent of the 1965 Act was to right past wrongs and to undo prejudice in the immigration system. And, of course, the Constitution has the Establishment Clause. So
prohibiting establishment of a religion.
Establishment of religion. And therefore, you can't take religion into consideration in making public decisions. And so Trump could not ban all Muslims and get away with it. So we tried a kind of an end run by banning some Muslim countries.
Right. And the argument is it's not all Muslims. It's just these seven countries.
Just these seven countries, none of which had produced terrorists that have tried to attack the United States.
But what I'm getting at is that there's this move to level the playing field back now 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And it seems to be in contradiction to statute and the Establishment Clause. So that's interesting.
Well, this is a concerted legal attack from conservatives on the right. They also managed to attack the Voting Rights Act and get one of its key provisions removed. So they're trying to move back the advances of the civil rights era.
There's the 1952 legislation that they're claiming.
The McCarran-Walter Act was actually – it started out as an immigration reform effort under Truman.
Right.
And it passed, but it didn't pass in the reform spirit. It reaffirmed the quotas from the 1920s, and Truman vetoed it.
Right.
And it was passed over Truman's veto, who called it something like a slave act or something like that.
Yeah, he said, today we are protecting ourselves as we were in 1924 against being flooded by immigrants in Eastern Europe. This is fantastic. We do not need to be protected against immigrants from these countries. On the contrary, we want to stretch out a helping hand to save those who have managed to flee into Western Europe, to succor those who are brave enough to escape from barbarism, to welcome and restore them against the day when their countries will, as we hope, be free again.
Yeah, and it wasn't until 1965, after Kennedy martyred himself in the cause of civil rights and Johnson pushed through the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the 65 amendments to the Immigration Act were considered to be part of that civil rights program, to get rid of the prejudice that was built into the immigration system by banning Asians, banning Africans, banning people from the Middle East, and setting up quotas that discriminated against Southern and Eastern Europeans, which was very clearly a religious discrimination against Catholics from Italy and Poland and Jews from the Russian Pale.
Around 1962, my parents came in from Taiwan. So that's before the 65 Immigration Act. So how did they get in?
Well, there was a tiny during the Second World War, it became embarrassing to the U.S. government that we had a ban on Chinese immigration when China was our ally in the fight against fascism, Chiang Kai-shek at the time, of course. And so they put in small quotas so they could say, well, we no longer ban Chinese immigration. And so there were ways to get in, and especially people that were connected with U.S. military efforts and so on and had connections in the United States or relatives in the United States could gain entry, but only in small numbers.
Okay. So my parents squeezed in through that little.
Can I ask what, beyond the normative implications of this refugee ban, thinking of everything you've just taught us on the wall and Mexico, how would it play out to have a ban? I mean, there's one argument that these are not actually targeting the places most terrorism has actually originated from. But the second, how would a ban work? Would it work? Would it have unintended consequences like a wall? I mean,
well, it's bound to have unintended consequences. And Silicon Valley was fairly complacent in the wake of Trump's election. But then once this visa ban came into existence, it caused serious problems. And people weren't able to get to conferences. They weren't able to get their H visa people coming in. People were trapped out of the United States who had jobs in the United States. And it really was a wake-up call to a lot of business interests because we're like it or not, we're in an integrated global economy in which people and goods and services and capital are moving across international borders, and that's what makes the economy work. And if you try to hunker down and seal yourself off, you're just going to make yourself poorer while the rest of the world gets richer. You have to figure out ways to adapt to it and share. Any economic change brings costs and benefits, and some people don't benefit and some people pay costs. And you need to figure out internal transfer systems and policies to ease the pain of transition to a different economic order that will, in the end, produce better outcomes for everyone. But the leaders of both parties have really turned a blind eye to the people that have been harmed by globalization and mechanization and are, for whatever reason, unwilling to tax themselves, even at fairly low rates, to create a fund to transfer to people who need help adjusting to the new economic circumstances. And that's probably the biggest political failure of the last several years. And again, that's been bipartisan. And what you saw with the populist revolt that ultimately elected Trump, it was a giant flip of the bird to both parties, Democrat as well as Republican. And what we see now is Trump has essentially taken over, hijacked the Republican Party, and no one on the Republican side has the courage to oppose him.
Why can I just – I mean, I understand why President Trump would be pushing the refugee ban and calling for a wall. I understand the politics, but I don't quite get why President Obama would have been the deporter in chief, as he's called, given his political principles and, you know, it seems not to be someone who would be in favor. Why did he do it?
Well, I think he's a natural mediator trying to bring opposite sides together. That's his whole life, white and black, mediating these two polar opposites that have divided American society for so long. So, and that's just kind of the way he is. He's trying to find a middle ground. And he also, I think, for the first couple of years of his presidency, drank his own Kool-Aid. And he believed he was the great mediator who could bring the country together. There was hope and he was going to end partisan bickering. And so his strategy was to launch a hard line upon assuming office. He increased the size of the Border Patrol and ramped up deportations, figuring that if he did his part on and was hardline and enforcing the border and enforcing immigration laws, then naturally reasonable Republicans will come over and compromise and come to a pathway for legalization and reform of the rest of the system. But what he failed to appreciate was that basically Republicans swore a blood oath to block anything that he did. And he didn't move in the first 2 years when he had a chance for immigration reform. And part of it's bad luck. I think if Ted Kennedy hadn't gotten sick and died, that we would have had a different kind of health care reform bill. And I think we would have had immigration reform.
He was central to the 65 legislation.
He was central, and he
pushes it.
And he was someone that could reach across the aisle.
Right.
I mean, the Dream program was him and Orrin Hatch, the Dreamer legislation, and he had a national constituency, and he wasn't afraid to stand up.
And then one more question on kind of clarifying myth versus reality. The other part of this argument, obviously, not with the refugees so much as with certainly immigrants from Mexico, is that there's more crime and more dissolution in the communities where they reside. Is there any evidence to support that?
No, the evidence is to the contrary. Immigrant neighborhoods have lower crime rates than native neighborhoods. Immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than natives. And this only makes sense. If you're a newcomer in a country, the last thing you want to do is cause trouble for the natives and call attention to yourself. So they make efforts to stay out of trouble. And if it's the case that immigrants as a whole have a lower crime rate than natives, then if you exclude immigrants, you're actually going to raise the average crime rate. By keeping people who have low crime rates out of the country, the average has to rise. Mm-hmm. So it just doesn't make any sense at all, and it's completely untrue. But a lot of people think in kind of specious terms. So you think, oh, well, if this person hadn't been here, this wouldn't have happened. They exercise in kind of a fraudulent, counterfactual way of thinking. But societies don't work that way. People commit crimes, and immigrants as people commit fewer than natives.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm sitting here, I'm listening, and you present a really kind of dire picture. You have policy that's not based on reality. You have punitive programs that are a kind of product of partisanship, of racial politics, and even of economic self-interest. You have a bipartisan, not consensus, but bipartisan support for variations of this, including President Obama. Who did this, and we're moving in a direction where with the Republican Congress and Trump, the possibility for an alternative seems to diminish. So I'm sure people listening will hear that. You're not a politician, you're a scholar of these patterns of demography, but is there a path forward to a more rational and humane policy?
Right. What would a more reasonable policy, what would be a more reasoned policy look like?
Well, I co-authored an op-ed piece in the New York Times with Jorge Castaneda, who is a former foreign minister of Mexico. And we pointed out that there are four pillars of immigration reform. One was to get control of the border, of course. That's always number one. adjust the quotas for Mexico and Canada in light of the fact that under NAFTA, it's creating demand for legal, legitimate demand for legal visas, increase the size of the guest worker program, and come up with a pathway to legalization. Well,
for these 11 million people.
For these 11 million people. Mm-hmm. And but most of those problems have already been kind of solved through their own natural processes. So the legal quotas are still 20,000 persons per year. We're taking in 150 to 200,000, and that's because relatives of U.S. citizens, immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, are exempt from the quotas. And Congress, in 1996 legislation, started stripping away rights of non-citizens and denying non-citizens access to certain social services, even if they were legal. So this spurred a massive move towards naturalization, assuming American citizenship. And by naturalizing, if you're a permanent resident, you have the right to bring in your spouse and minor children subject to numerical limitations. They get in line and wait for one of those 20,000 visas to pop up. But if that person suddenly naturalizes and becomes an American citizen, spouses and minor children come in immediately, subject to no limitation, and parents come in immediately, subject to no limitation, and brothers and sisters get the right to go and stand in line for
That path exists now.
That path exists now, and so basically, the Mexicans have self increased their own quota by becoming U.S. citizens and bringing in their relatives. And meanwhile, quietly, Congress has authorized a substantial expansion in guest worker migration. So it's not simply H-1B and H-1A or H-2A and H-2B visas, business visas and agricultural visas, work visas. It's all kinds of visas, especially under NAFTA, with investor visas, exchange visas, business visas, and there's a special TN visa, the NAFTA temporary professional visa, that unlike the H visas, can be renewed ad infinitum. It doesn't have a time limitation. H visas you can do for 2-3 year slots, and then you have to either adjust status or leave. But that's not true for TN visas. And so the guest worker program is actually running 350 to 400,000 people. And the border is as controlled as ever going to be. It's zero for 8 years now, 9 years. So three of the four things have been done, more or less. And we could talk about how we could do it better. But the crying need is for a pathway of legalization for the 11 million people. An increasing fraction of whom are now parents of American citizen kids who have been in the country for now an average of like 15 years and who are overwhelmingly non-criminal.
Mm-hmm. So the pathway is what some would call amnesty and naturalization.
Well, I wouldn't call I'm sure some people will call it amnesty, but we have to make some distinctions. I would call it an earned legalization. So you come out, register, you maybe even pay a fine for your transgression. Immigration violations, for the most part, are civil law. It's not criminal law. So you pay a fine. Okay, you're bad. And then you learn English. You acquire experience in the United States. You pay your taxes. You be a good person. And over time, you gain the right to become a permanent resident alien. None of these programs are a path to citizenship. Because they're all path to permanent legal residence. Once you're a permanent legal resident, then in 5 years, if you so choose, you can apply for citizenship and take the test and pay the fee. But all you get from these reform programs is a pathway to legal status.
Well, we're actually out of time, but I want to thank you, Doug, for being on the show. Kind of one of our goals, I think, is to bring voices from social sciences and thoughtful journalists who can expose some of the myths that are so prevalent in our political debates. So I feel like we learned a lot about immigration today and border control. So thank you for being with us.
Well, I'm happy to try to get the word out. It's not easy.
And that's it for Politics and Polls. Thanks for joining the show, and we'll be back next week.
Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.